Today is May 27th, 1984. My name is Tika Ward. I'm interviewing Ann Kuiper. We are at 1151 Dove Road, Louisville, Kentucky. Our topic is Lou Tate and the Little Loom House. As we begin, tell me something about yourself first.
Well, I've lived in Louisville for the past several years, but I grew up visiting in Louisville at the Little Loom Houses. My husband and I live here on Dove Road, and I'm a medical technologist, and I'm a blood banker within the aspect of medical technologists, and we have several adopted children, and we're foster parents as well. And a lot of the things that I do in my life probably are greatly influenced by things that Lou Tate did or didn't do, as the case may be. But we're really glad to get a chance to talk about her and the events that we do remember as we remember them. Actually, everyone laughs when I say that I have been going to the Loom Houses all my life, literally, and I was there before I was born. And that's a very true statement. My grandmother, who raised me down at Gamaliel, down Monroe County in Cumberland County, Kentucky, had a lifelong interest in weaving since her and spinning, since her grandmothers had always kept up these crafts, and she'd also picked up a pretty good expertise as a quilter. So in the early 30s, this grandmother had made a quilt that she exhibited at the state fair, and it won first prize. Well, while she was up viewing her handiwork hanging, she ran across a young lady who was giving a weaving demonstration and attempting to spin. And my grandmother went over and made her acquaintance and explained to her the finer arts of spinning. And they got to talking, and she says, "My daughter should know you. She's interested in weaving." And this lady that my grandmother met was a young woman that was calling herself Lou Tate. And she says, "Well, I'd love to know your daughter, because she knows people down in southern Kentucky." So they talked on for a little bit, and as it was, the two girls actually knew each other and had just completed a summer school term where they both taken analytical geometry together at Berea and competed, because they were the only two girls in the class, I understand. They each thought the other one was the smartest thing they'd ever seen, and they were so busy competing for their grades they never bothered to be friends. Well, as it was, my grandmother went home and told her daughter, whose name was Mabel, about this young woman who was interested in learning to cipher weaving patterns. And my mother knew something of this, so it wasn't too long till my mother jumped in her old jalopy and came to Louisville, and they made friends within a couple of weeks. And this became a lifelong friendship between the two families, because these two young women trucked around in Monroe County and Cumberland, Metcalf and Barron, and probably Warren County and Allen, as best I understand, visiting. And between the two of them, they could get a foothold in any household they chose. I think Lou Tate may have had an old Jeep. I have heard reference made to this. And my mother was not afraid of riding horseback. Whichever way they had to go to get back in the hills and hollows, they literally did. Now, Lou Tate had her in that part of the state because she had relatives, the Fords, down around Cave City, and then she herself had been born in Bowling Green in Warren County, and she had some relatives there. But her father had been a railroad man, and every little stop that the railroad made to refuel or rewater or whatever, the conductors had became acquainted with the storekeepers and what have you up and down the course of the railroad, so that there was a lot of people that knew who her father was. He was the conductor on the L&N that passed by so-and-so. So she had a way to introduce herself. And she was related to certain people, and she could go in as, "This is old Aunt Sally's great niece, and so-and-so, and she's interested in your weaving patterns or your what you have done here, and she could begin to talk to people. And my mother had a unique situation in that her father, whose name was R.A. Pamore, and a lot of people in the state know him as Professor Pamore, her father was a minister in the Church of Christ, and he was a school teacher from the time he was about 15 years old, and he taught in the schools down through there and went, preached at one church for literally 40-some years, so he married three generations, and if they weren't kin to my mother, my grandfather, they'd been to school to him. If they hadn't been to school to him, they'd been married by him, so there wasn't any escaping these two women when they went knocking on your door. And they literally did. And I've heard wonderful stories told by my grandmother about their episodes of going up and down the creeks and visiting people and interviewing them and looking at their old pieces of scrap coverlets and going in and saying, "Oh yeah, we'll look at any old scrap you've got," and going out to the barnyard where they were using pieces of scrap maybe as a horse blanket, or you know, finding this little tatter of a Lindsay Woolsey here or this, that, and another. And she said, you know, for years thereafter, she'd go into communities with my grandfather, because he'd be preaching in some different church as a special guest, and people would say, you know, "You still know that lady that was a weaving lady and was interested in these little pieces." So as when I was a little girl, I saw the little pieces still being sent to Lou Tate as a result of these early trappings around that these women did. And they did learn to decipher, as they called it, the quilt, the weaving patterns. They learned a lot about the old quilts as they went around, and they learned a lot about basket weaving, because a lot of the weavers, particularly the ones I knew up in Cumberland County, seemed to always be into basket weaving too. So there was a fondness developed for those three forms of crafts right there early on. Well, my mother and Lou Tate, as I say, they became like sisters. Neither one of them had sisters, and they each had a realm of friends that enjoyed each other as time went on. And my mother, being the daughter of a well-known minister and school teacher and school superintendent in the area, had certain difficulties in her life when it came to dating. So she would come to Louisville and spend a week with Lou Tate in Louisville, and my father would meet her there. So all their courting literally went on at Lou Tate's parents' house, down an old house down on 3rd Street. Now, I know the house when I see it. I can only remember having been in it one time when I was about 5 years old. And at that time, the house had already been sold, and they were clearing stuff out of it. But I do remember going in it, and I remember it was quite an imposing house. And my father tells wonderful stories of coming up here and spending a weekend or a few days at Lou Tate's parents' home. And he always loved Lou Tate's mother and father, Mr. and Ms. Bowsman, and her Aunt Lessie, who was a retarded lady who was a sister of Mr. Bowsman, I believe. And then he remembers Lou Tate's grandmother, and I believe it would be her grandmother Ford that lived with him at the time. And she was quite a character, and he would laugh and giggle about that. Miss Ford wouldn't sometimes realize that he had arrived, and sometimes there'd be some shifting around of beds, and she'd go down the hall and she'd say, "Lord have mercy, Lou Tate, there's a man in this bedroom." Then she'd realize it was Lemuel, and it would be all right. She'd know that he'd come up to visit. But and oftentimes they had guests in, and I think Mr. Bowsman had a love for playing cards, and most any time that anybody would come in, why, there was always a bridge game going on, and somebody would be invited to join in the bridge game, or there'd be guests coming in, and it was a very congenial atmosphere and a fun time, and the young women had a lot in common, and a lot of their interests, they were both kind of pioneers in certain ways. Lou Tate at that time had a room there in her parents' home that she used as a gallery, and she sold out of that room, and she wove there, and it wasn't until some few years later that her mother and she purchased the property that we now call the Little Loom House. And I think that her mother may have inherited some money and decided to use it for something that she could leave to Lou Tate, may have been the way that came about. At least that was what Lou Tate always inferred when she would speak of it. And they found this property up on Kenwood Hill Road, and it was just a little tiny path almost to get there when I could first remember. It was just a really ramshackled road, and there weren't too many houses. And I know there's pictures of my brother when he was about 2 years old there, sitting on the front porch that we have. And I know my father says, you know, that I was there all my life. But even before there was my brother or I, either one, there was a famous wedding dress. And in 1939, my mother and father did decide they were going to get married. And I guess it was 1940 by the time maybe the wedding took place. But I have to think about that a minute. It was 1940, but 1939, the wedding dress was planned for, and my mother designed the fabric of this dress. She'd become an accomplished weaver by this time. She designed this fabric, and she designed her dress, and she wove the fabric and made the dress. And she was a determined soul, and she made it to her own liking, and my mother helped her make it, and it was just beautiful. It was now it's ecru. I'm sure at the time it was woven, it was very white, but it's aged to an ecru color over the years, and it was a linen weave with a silk overshot. And she came to Louisville to finish weaving it, or to weave it, because she had trouble with that big loom managed always in her own home. And you will meet weavers that come to the loom houses now that still talk about weaving, having woven a few threads in the dress for good luck, because this was a tradition. If you were weaving a wedding dress, so you had everyone weave an extra thread or two in for good luck. And this dress was worn by my mother, and she carried a fan with a dress that was a silk fan, and it belonged to Lou Tate's family, and that was a something borrowed. And this was I don't know how old the fan was, but it had been around a long time in Lou Tate's family, and she said it was a wedding fan. It was always carried in weddings, and it always brought good luck to the marriage, and there was very few disruptions of marriages in which this fan was carried. But the only way that it would keep its potent powers was to be used frequently in weddings. So this fan was carried by my mother, and she tied tea roses on long streamers to this fan, and the roses were grown in my grandmother Pelmore's garden in Glasgow, and the wedding took place in Glasgow. It was an outdoor wedding, and it was a lovely affair. And the wedding dress, along with some table linens that my mother had woven that summer, then were included in a group of materials that Lou Tate put on an exhibit, and they were on exhibit for 7 years. I know they stayed for several months at Marshall Field in Chicago, and the only reason we have the wedding dress today in our family is that they were on exhibit at that time, because in 1949 our house burned, and many of the things she had woven were destroyed. Not everything, but we saved an amazing amount. But the wedding dress was on exhibit at the time, so it was probably a lucky thing that it was. And it's been used in a lot of exhibits since then, and I used it at my own wedding. And if all goes well, a friend of mine may use it, or at least use the fan. I don't know whether she's going to manage to fit into the dress this summer or not. But it's been a source of a lot of fun and pleasure over the years, and it's certainly an heirloom that not many families would ever have. So our roots go from the beginning back to Lou Tate. The first conscious memory I have of Lou Tate and of the loom houses comes when I was about 5 years old, and my mother had been dead then for a couple of years, and I was living with my grandmother down in Monroe County. We just had moved down there. Not Monroe County, that was before. We moved to Marybone in Cumberland County. And we came up and spent a few days with Lou Tate, and I judge it was in the fall, because I remember the smell of the leaves and the acorns and playing with the acorns. And at that time there was a little blue and pink pinafore that somebody had woven and made, and Lou Tate had me dress up in that and had my photograph taken upstairs in the bottom cabin against the big, massive door there, and I could always remember that door. And a professional photographer came out to take the picture, and she used this as a cover of one of her weaving magazines then later on. And I thought this was big stuff. I think that picture of me and my little pinafore probably was around a 1950 or 1951 production of the weaving at the Little Lim House. And my mother's picture occurred a few years earlier, obviously. It was in 1940, weaving at the Lim House. If anybody wants to look at it, well, they'll find her picture on page 23, and it shows her in the dress and the fan and the garden setting, which was down at Glasgow, Kentucky. And incidentally, the property that was taken on is now where Louie Nunn lives. And I don't know that they maintained all the garden, but this grandmother that was Grandmother Palmore had a wonderful garden and lots of daylilies and iris and early spring flowers of all kinds, and she actually propagated irises and hybridized them to get her own colors and sold iris. That was her big hobby. But if you look around up at the Little Lim House today, you see lots of little flowers up there, and some of them came from that same garden down in Glasgow, because I'm quite sure from hearing Lou Tate tell it that she could never leave a weekend at Mother's house without some sort of flower being stuffed in her hand, and after she had a place to put it up at the Lim House. That's why she kept, every year, she was really diligent about doing her spring planting. And I well remember that as I was a teenager and got to help later on. But as I say, my first memories of the Little Lim Houses were very warm, and I know it was in the fall. I can remember the smell of the acorns. I can remember the smell of the oak leaves. I can remember at that time that the fireplace there was still used as a fireplace and sometimes to cook on. And there would be a wonderful old couch in front of the fireplace, and it was kind of a day bed, and there was the most wonderful array of colors you could ever imagine, because there were shelves around with just loom after loom stacked upon them, and there was a wonderful little cloth monkey with a tartan, and he was there to play with. And underneath the window looking out towards the driveway, there was always a basket, and from the very, very earliest memories, I remember the basket, and it had spools that thread had come off of, and old shuttles, and boxes, and medicine boxes. At that time, medicine often came in black cardboard boxes that fit together. They were little cylinder-like things, and this was where children could always go and get something to play with. And you were free to get anything out of that basket and play with that you wanted to. And from the very beginning, you always knew that this was the place that you were most welcome as a child. My brother felt that way about it, too. He didn't keep up with Lou Tate over the years as much as I did, but she and he had a very warm relationship in spite of that, and he has a lot of good memories. The family always tells jokes on him that he was about 4 or 5 years old and toddling and running around up there, and there was a crowd of people in, as there often was. And he goes up and he wanted his Auntie Tate. And one of the ladies that was there took exception to this, and he says, "Well, then Lou Tate." And she says, "Well, you should say Miss Lou Tate." And he looked at her in great dignity. He says, "If I'll miss her, I'll miss Bowsman her, thank you." And no one messed with him and Lou Tate from then on. Now, my brother and I always called her Tate. We did that. And when I was older and came to Louisville to visit as a preteen and a teenager, I was aghast when all of her other social friends called her Lou. I just thought somewhere that this wasn't right. And it took me several years to accommodate the idea that you could call her Lou. As far as I was concerned, it was Tate, or Aunt Tate. But it was interesting because she was moving things, that particular visit, she was moving things from their Third Street house out to a Second Street house and up to the cabins all at one time. And I believe that her father, I know her father was still living at the time, and they were, he and Aunt Lessie were living in a house down on Second Street, a small house, and my grandmother and grandfather and I stayed down there, but we spent a lot of time visiting up at the cabins on that particular visit. So I remember Mr. Bowsman, and I remember Aunt Lessie, and Mr. Bowsman was quite an imposing man, and he had a coal frame out in his backyard and always was growing things. He had quite a green thumb. And Aunt Lessie was a lovely lady, and she was, I think we would call her today in the class of educable mentally retarded. And she had always been cared for with love in the family, and every place any body from that family went, Aunt Lessie went right along as she was able to. And I remember playing dolls with Aunt Lessie and helping her iron handkerchiefs and doing things like that. You know, as far as I was concerned, Aunt Lessie was just a dear person. At that time, I was living with my grandparents down in Marybone, on the Marybone Creek down in Cumberland County. And over the next couple of years, I know that Lou Tate spent some time, a few weekends, coming down there to visit us. And she always would come with amazing presents in hand. Sometimes there'd be little bottles of perfume. I have quilts that I use on my bed now that were quilts from her mother's, because she didn't have the space to store all this stuff that her mother's family had. And she believed that I would enjoy them, so she would bring them down to my grandmother and say, hang on to these till Aunt Ellen gets bigger and she can have them. Well, I know at that time that I got my first loom, and I was not going to school then. Lou Tate was working on some sort of project with a school up in Frankfurt for mentally handicapped children. And she had a bunch of 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds that she was interested in, and I happened to be one of them. And somewhere or other, she got us tested, or IQ tested. I don't know whether she asked the school to do it. I don't know how it happened, but she knew what our IQs all were. And we were very young, and she taught us to weave. And then she asked us to tell her back how we perceived it. And then we would show things to other children. And based on our approach to things, she modified her teaching techniques for these retarded children, and she had quite an active program over the years. As I can remember, sometime I must have been around 9 or 10 when I was visiting her, going to Frankfurt with her to deliver looms. And I remember that day for another good reason. She always had this talent. If there was a youngster along, she made it a special day. There was an old hotel there in Frankfurt, and so it was a special treat to get to take this child in to order something. And you couldn't order hamburgers or anything you ever had anyplace else. If you were going to go to some place like this, you had to try something new and different that you'd never done before. This was the cardinal rule. I can remember, I think around 52 or 53, that Lou Tate met us at the Kentucky Building in Bowling Green. And she had an old Jeep station wagon at this time, and it was sort of modified in the back without too many seats so you could fit limbs in. My grandmother and I, and my grandfather took us over there, and I got to remember that was the first time I ever got to see the Kentucky Building there. And we stayed through Lou Tate's presentation, and then we rode back with her to Louisville and spent a week or so. And I can't remember exactly how old I was, but I remember the old station wagon and that the looms just fit in it just so. And I remember learning how to take the loom tables apart at that time. Because if you were with Lou Tate, from the time you could pick up or carry anything, you were picking up and carrying, and you were learning how to do it well as anybody else. And you were expected, if you once you knew how to do something, if you saw it needed to be done from then on, you did it. You were never have to be reminded to again. She was a stern lady in that aspect, but you also were rewarded with a lot of opportunities to do things that perhaps you wouldn't have gotten, your parents or someone else would not have let you do. Under very guided circumstances, she introduced you to people and situations that were unusual. They were particularly unusual in my case because I was being raised by grandparents under rather unusual circumstances. And being as this grandfather was the person he was, I don't suppose I would have ever been in a restaurant that served liquor at a party that beer was being served at. And, you know, Lou Tate was very cautious to explain to me that there was different types of lifestyles and what happened in these social settings. And later on in life, I began to appreciate that it was so nice of her to have allowed this little girl from way out in the country to have seen, and she made a special efforts that you got to see these different ways of living and meet people and go to the adult parties with her. Now, mind you, she had a way of turning things to make it be for her own amusement at times. When I was about 14 or 15, as I say, every year I spent about 2 weeks with Lou Tate from the time I was about 9 or 10 on. Wow. It would be, if someone was coming to Louisville, say, for the state basketball tournament, which most people from out in the state do, especially if they're teams are real active. Well, I would get a ride with one of the teachers, and she would meet me someplace or another at a restaurant or someplace near the fairgrounds, and I could spend the weekend with her and then maybe go to a ball game if I chose and then go back home. And this was great for a 10 or 12-year-old child to be able to do. From the time I was sixth grade on, this was a privilege. If I wanted to come to Louisville with somebody to do something and stay at Lou Tate's, well, I could. And you know, you saw a different side of her because you stayed there over the years than most people saw. You know, I got to be with her enough that I heard the stories about some of her fun times as a young woman. I got to hear her stories about some of her boyfriends. I never got to meet any of them, but I sure heard stories about them. And saw some of the things that maybe some of them would send to her sometimes. And there was one man, I never did remember his name, but he evidently was a curator with a museum of some national status, and he would often send her little gifts. And when he would come to Louisville, why, he would come out with liver pate and fine crackers and wine, and they would sit up on the hill and reminisce over old times and argue over Grecian pottery and over mythology and why that all weaving textiles from all over the world would have common threads of patterns in them like winged dragons and, you know, the imagery that is common to humankind, and they would argue over the theories of where this comes from in the mind of the American Indian as opposed to someone in Asia, as opposed to someone from a whole other part of the world. And you know, it was fascinating to me to hear these discussions, or hear that these discussions had taken place. And it was fascinating to realize that you could live upstairs in a cabin and eat off of a hot plate. And of course, we didn't. There was no water in the house. You had to go down to Sue Kendrick's to get water to drink. And once in a while, Lou Tate would drop me off for a ceremonial bath. But other than that, it was pretty much camp-style living. So I learned to appreciate getting along with that very much. But it was certainly an elegant camp style living because you could, every night she would load up any kids she could find. And the dog, Skipper. I failed to mention Skipper. And off we go. By that time she had a blue Ford, I believe, station wagon, and it was very famous. We'd go flying up and down the hill in that, and we'd go out for ice cream cones or 12-cent hamburgers. There was some place down the hill that you could buy 12-cent hamburgers. And any child that was around was welcome to jump in and go along for these little trips out. And then once in a while, she had a great love for seafood, and we would go to some seafood restaurant here in town and dine on things that you could never have gotten in Monroe County, to say the least. And so that was quite fun. And I was always amazed at what she would wear when we would go out to these episodes, because she was, I remember that she bought me my first pair of high heels. And I was up here for Easter or spring break or something, and I was about 12 or 13, and she decided I need a pair of high heels. So she took me down to buy a pair of little white heels, and she was very proud of that. But now her dress style was something different than the latest fashion. And she would always have these jumpers. In later years, I made her some jumpers, and Sally Moss would make her jumpers, because she could never have bought anything she would have worn. She would wear old shorts and jumpers, and if you were just around the house there casually, a lot of times she'd have on a princess slip and a man's shirt. And she would talk to me about the practicality of a princess slip and a man's shirt.
The end of side one. This is side two of interview one with Ann Kuiper.
As I was saying, the princess slip and the old man's shirt was a trademark of what Lou Tate wore, and she said it was practical because that if you were taking care of invalid people or that might need attention in the middle of the night, that a woman's gown or pajamas sometimes was awkward, and that you could, that a slip was comfortable to sleep in, and a man's shirt you could just slip on and be ready to face whatever came along. So that's what she generally wore. Now, occasionally, we would slip a pair of shorts on over the princess slip, and sometimes the princess slip would dangle a mite here and there. I remember one time going to the bank with her, and she had on one of her more colorful outfits, and she walked in as her long-handled underwear was creeping out from under whatever it was she had on, and her old coat was dragging a bit here and there, and she looked around and says, "There are folks looking at us, Anna." And I said, "Yes." She says, "Don't let that bother you. In some countries, I would just be called quaint and colorful." So, it was fun. It really was. She had loved to go to these shopping, to shop, and she always had what she called her mad money. And in later years, I came to realize her mad money was probably money that came to her from stocks from the L&N Railroad that her father had left to her, and the interest on this stock she would put away for to blow, and it was always to blow on kids. And so there was always this little change here and there and somewhere, and a few dollars in a little jar, and there was beautiful silver and glassware and things like that all over the place, and anytime you were dusting for her, you'd find little piles of money. But you never, no one ever touched it. This was just kind of the way it was. She put this away, and you know this was part of the mad money. And whenever you went shopping, you'd always come up with these little trinkets and treasures. Going to the grocery store was no exception. At that time, she shopped a lot there near Coy's Manor Shopping Center near her home. And everyone in the shopping center knew her and either loved her or tolerated her, as the case may be. And I well remember one time when I was about 15 going shopping and helping her get through the checkout line, and this lady was having this conversation and with Lou Tate, and Lou Tate gives me one of her looks, and she said, handed me something to put in the grocery cart, and the woman who was the checker said, "My goodness, this young lady that you have with you resembles you a lot." And there is some resemblance, I think. Lou Tate and I always did have just a little bit. There was some family resemblances. And Lou Tate smiled. She said, "Yes, this is my illegitimate daughter home from school." And left the lady with all the rumors they'd ever wanted to have confirmed right there. I was just about to choke to death. I was giggling so hard. And off we went. Lou Tate never cracked a smile. And but till later, she says, "I always did want to do that." And that wasn't the only time she ever pulled that stunt with me, by any means. And we laughed about it because I always considered her my second mom, and she did in some ways treat me like maybe an adopted daughter in a lot of ways. Because I think that I got an unusual share of her love and an unusual share of her anger and an unusual share of family things that she wanted kept within the family over the years, because there would always be some little family heirloom piece that would suddenly appear in my Christmas boxes, and or a little piece of silver. She loved silver, and there was hardly a Christmas that would go by but what I wouldn't get a little silver pin, sterling silver pin. She loved those, or some little something. And then when I got to be older, it was little pieces of silver serving pieces or spoons. Her family had quite a collection of elegant things like this, and she believed in passing them on. There are a lot of other young women that she cherished and loved, Alan Tenney for one, and the Kendricks girls too, that have been benefit of much of these beautiful things, but I think I've probably got as many or more of the ones that belong to her family than most people. And I sure have cherished them and enjoyed them over the years. Where to go from here? I have to think about Lou Tate's involvement with young people as being a real strong influence to me. She had her bachelor's degree, I believe, in mathematics, and her master's degree was from the University of Michigan in history, and her thesis was in the antebellum historical time. And she focused a lot on these patterns, coverlet patterns, in her thesis. And she and my mother were both mathematicians, so that was their natural love of the weaving, was that this was applied mathematics. This was the rhythm and the beauty of mathematics. And they were both artistic and musical people, so it really came together for them in their love for weaving. Now, Lou Tate wove as a young woman for commercial purposes to support herself to some extent, because she sold the coverlids, and you see ads and old pieces of flyers that you'll find around the cabins there where the coverlid was so much and the baby blanket was so much. So she wove what she would call commercially. But that was not her love. Her love was the research, was trying to figure out how these things had been transmitted from person to person and by what code and method, and why the mind had come up with some of these patterns, the history of the patterns, why it was called Snail's Trail and Cat's Track, why it was called Lover's Knot. You know, this was where the intrigue came from for her. Also, too, the intrigue came for her in seeing how children's minds grasped these things, because basically she was a teacher. And I guess a lot of people don't know that she actually did teach school at some points in her life. If I'm not mistaken, her first teaching position was in Harlan, Kentucky, and she was probably an 8th grade PE teacher, is the nearest thing I can understand to what we would relate it to today. She taught there for a year, and she was very disheartened, I believe, by that experience. She relied heavily on social things for young people that age, and folk dancing, and learning just basic skills of living, and I'm not for sure that these were so well received in Harlan. I never heard her talk a lot about that year of teaching. I believe that her second year of teaching probably occurred at the President Hoover's school, the President's school, in the Rapidan Mountains or in Virginia, and there is a scrapbook of that, and I've heard her talk of that many times, and of her friend that was the main teacher, and she was the assistant teacher. And she would talk about these handsome young men that were the employees of the president that would come swooping up to their cabin on the horseback and invite them to come down to dinner with the president. And she would also talk about that she and Mrs. Hoover going shopping in Washington. Apparently, Mrs. Hoover enjoyed the company of these two young women and liked to go shopping, particularly for hats. Besides shopping with Mrs. Hoover, Lutate would tell me a few times about experiences of teaching in that school in the Rapidan Valley, and she talked about the little boy that had inspired President Hoover to have a school put there, and he apparently was a child who the president saw fishing someplace and asked him where he went to school, and he said, "I have no school." And at that point in time, there were no schools to speak of in the mountains, so this was something like what we would think of as a settlement school. And he funded it, and I guess maybe had the building built. It was near a camp that he used for relaxation purposes during his presidency. And this became he and Mrs. Hoover's pet charitable endeavor, this little school did. And while they were supposed to be teaching the children the reading and writing and arithmetic, Lutate was brought in as her to try and teach these women and capitalize on what they called home industries, to try and give them a sense of something they could do that was marketable. And so the idea was that she was going to go out and, with her basic knowledge of weaving, and increase their skills where they would do cottage industries of rugs and things like this. And I think they indeed apparently did have looms in the second story of her school building. That's where the girls lived. But to hear Lutate tell it, that wasn't the way it worked out. She said they spent most of their time teaching basic hygiene and showing movies on how to take a bath, and trying to convince people that they wouldn't die if they took a bath, and loading the children up and somehow in a bus and taking them out of the valley to see the county seat town and giving them exposure to life a little bit. So she never felt that she accomplished the things she was hired to do in that school setting, but she did have a wonderful time, and it was if you heard her tell it, you'd think it was kind of a romantic time with these young men coming up from the president's camp and inviting you to come to dinner, and there you were in your jeans and having blackberry juice all over you because you've been out picking blackberries and having to clean up real quick and go down to dine with the president, although you just eaten the meal and you didn't dare say no, and trying to keep a clean pair of white gloves ready to go if it was formal. And you know, the stories that she would tell were wonderful. But I do believe that she and Mrs. Hoover had some rapport that was unusual, because Lutate, as she came back to Kentucky and got into her weaving, started out on large looms, which was the loom that was available, these big floor-standing looms. Well, Mrs. Hoover apparently was interested in the Girl Scouts and interested in young women, and she felt that times were changing for women, and that their houses were going to be smaller, that women were going to be mobile, living in their own apartments at the time, and that they should have crafts that were mobile also. So somewhere along the line, she and Lutate had conversations about, wouldn't it be nice if there were looms that were small enough and portable enough to meet the needs of the future woman? And I believe, after having heard Lutate talk about this over the years, that this was where her impetus first came to make a small portable table loom, was thinking about Mrs. Hoover and the Girl Scouts. Now, she had a different impetus for this as time wore on and the 30s changed to the 40s, because she kept up with her weaving, but she also became some sort of a draftsman out at, what would be International Harvester's building now, was some sort of a design drafting in the aircraft industry. And she was a design draftsman for a number of years there during the war. And also, she was what I would call one of the first occupational therapists. You will find in all weaving in Kentucky, or weaving at the Little Loom House, books, pictures, and comments made about using weaving as a rehabilitative technique for people that had battlefield injuries and had lost a limb, or in fact lost the will to live. And I have heard her many times talk about the officers and people from Fort Knox would come into the loom houses on Sunday afternoon for tea and pink lemonade. And it wasn't until I was grown that I understood where the pink came from, pink lemonade. That was the little grenadine that was only added to it after 5, after the children had left. and she would talk about that they were using the weaving to try and rehabilitate some of the men that were injured. And I know over the years I have seen that she carried on correspondence with various occupational therapy groups, and there would be people that would be coming and staying for a week or so with her that would be learning to warp looms, would be learning to do new techniques, and would be going to take them back to military hospitals, mental hospitals, and different types of settings like this over the years. So I have always felt that she really pioneered some of the use of this type of craft and art form as a occupational therapy technique tool. And she felt very keenly that her little table model looms that you could switch with your hand were particularly appropriate because someone without legs could set them on his table side, his table over the lap tray, and weave as well as anyone else. And she, I've heard her discuss these needs at different sundry times. She also, if I remember right, was able to teach some blind people to weave, and she certainly worked with all kinds of other handicaps to allow people this form of creation. I'm sure there are other people that remember those days during the 40s and lived them as Lou Tate did and remember people, places, and times. I just recall having heard it talked about a lot and knowing that there was the interchange from the occupational therapy end, there was a social interchange, and it was the cabins became a time of relaxation and a good time for Sunday afternoon, and there was always this type of relaxed social atmosphere out there, and I'm sure that carried on for many, many years. I know it still was that way somewhat at times in the early 50s when I was a child visiting there. As it went into the 60s, that atmosphere had changed. Lou Tate was not as well as she once was. She was bitter towards many people. She felt deserted by other weavers in the community at times, and she felt particularly betrayed by the community in which she lived. On a very practical basis, the surrounding grounds around her home had been made into a more modern subdivision. Houses were being built, and it was causing tremendous soil erosion, and I can think of one house just down the hill from her that I remember seeing this huge gully filled in with trash and brush, and then a house built on top of it. And she felt that the builders were just eroding the lovely hill, and up at the top of the hill above the cabins there was a natural fossil bed that was just being destroyed. And you know, gone were the days when you could go to the cabins and weave and have a picnic lunch under the trees and take a hike up to the fossil beds. And, you know, this was such a romantic type of life, and there was hardly anyone else out there, a few other cabins, a few other congenial neighbors. But now there were people that were building these more modern buildings. There was a developer that had no respect for the natural terrain of the land, and she felt that her way of life was being encroached upon. And I remember the battles in court, even when she would be harassed, and people took objection to the fact that she had a well-maintained outhouse. And there was many a hate campaign, apparently, that revolved around that. These hate campaigns and dissension with the neighbors, and I guess it was really a fact that Lou Tate's lifestyle was different from anybody else's that you ever saw or hoped to see. And people just really didn't understand her. She was an outcast in her own neighborhood in many instances, while she was so well accepted all over the world because her correspondence and her phone calls, I was there enough that I would receive the phone calls for her sometimes. You know, she was respected as a weaver and as an historian and as an acute reviewer of the condition of humanity. But this was not what she was known as in the neighborhood. And this played upon her because she lived it was a lonely life. I can remember in the 60s, John and I married in 1963, and she was able to come to our wedding. And I have to interject this because I hadn't prepared my husband to be at all for Lou Tate. And so we lived in this little small house in Gamaliel, Kentucky, and my grandparents had raised me. We were quite elderly at the time. It was going to be a home wedding. And Lou Tate said, "Yes, I'll come, and I'll bring the wedding cake." So I said, "Fine." And so we get everything all ready, and it's just about 10, 12 people there, just most intimate family members and a few other guests. And here Lou Tate was buzzing around in the kitchen undoing this cake, and she had on this strange dress and some odd jewelry, and her hair was its own unique style of non-cut. It just sort of sheared around a bowl, so to speak, and her run-over shoes. And, you know, I thought she was just wonderful. And John comes in, and he looks in the kitchen, and he looks at me, and he draws me over the side, and he says, "Is this some help that your grandmother's gotten in to help for the day, or what?" And it never occurred to me to explain Lou Tate to him. It just never, because I accepted her as just as she was. And it was such a shock to me that he thought she was the cleaning lady or the maid or somebody that would come in. Lord knows we didn't have many people like that. So this was a very strange thing for him. And I was so shocked by that I could begin to see that people that didn't know her and love her all her life were surprised at her and a little bit taken back at her in the way she was at that time. And that was 1963. We came to Louisville and visited her shortly after we were married and stayed at her house a week or so. And John grew to appreciate her for the unique person that she was. But by that time, there was a lot of dissension, and there was a lot of sadness in her life and a lot of feeling of frustration. And I had known her at her best times and her most romantic, colorful times, and I had also been around enough to know her at times that weren't so good. And by the 60s, I was seeing more of the times that weren't so good, and I was able to understand why they weren't so good. And as a younger person, I didn't. Lou Tate, she admitted to me by the time that she died that she was alcoholic. And many of the little grocery runs you would do over the years were to go and buy this particular type of wine she enjoyed. And she never drank during the daytime when there were students there and when there were children there, but at night this particular wine was her constant companion. And I became more sensitive to that over the last years, because that too, as the disease of alcoholism, has the effect on the personality of changing. Lou Tate became, as I said a while ago, embittered, and she became more subject to mood change, and I saw this more frequently. And I grew to realize that it was reflective of the disease of alcoholism considerably, and the personality changes that I mentioned that come along with this. And I also, as time went on, I learned more about the disease of alcoholism. I am in the medical profession, and this sort of knowledge came to me as time went on. And I learned what the blackouts were that alcoholics had. And this explains some of the bitter things that happened with Lou Tate to me. I don't think that they made some of the hard times Lou Tate and I had personally any less painful, but they may have made them more understandable. And I know a lot of people are going to talk about that, you know, their times became less pleasant at Lou Tate's and atmosphere changed, and maybe the class you thought was going to be taught a certain way ended up being taught entirely differently, or you thought you were coming out to plant bulbs and suddenly you were asked to wash windows. And I was able to maybe adapt to this a little bit better over the years because I understood the disease of alcoholism. And while I never talked to her about that until towards the end of her life, I did understand that that's what was happening, and that she was doing things and not remembering exactly what she had arranged to do. And when she came to, she knew she was on some plan to do something and was trying to ad-lib a lot. And what she ended up feeling had happened, or the conversation that had happened with someone, was not really what had happened, but her ad-libbing made her try to fit in as best she could. Well, this ended up, as it always does, with disastrous relationships between people. And this happened with her students, this happened with other weavers, it happened with neighbors, it happened with family members. And it happened with Lou Tate and I, because she would invite, she loved to have parties. And it was always amazing. You know, she had this old ramshackle typewriter, and she always had tons of paper that was printed on with all kinds of things she was interested in. And on the backs of them, she'd write you these invitations, and they would be typed to the wee hours of the morning with the wine helping. And she would suddenly feel the urge for people to be around her and for a good time, and all of a sudden you'd be invited for this party. And you never knew what was going to happen, who was going to be at the party and who wasn't, and you might be skipped for 2 or 3 years and not know why. Then all of a sudden you were back on the list and being invited to these functions. Lou Tate's birthday is always a special time to me. She always had her last open house and a party kind of for herself. And you know, I could never go through an October without thinking about Lou Tate and her wonderful end open houses and fall parties that she would have. Most of the time at these parties, up until the very last years of her life, although she would drink at the parties, it was a good time. She really was not to excess. And only would you have known what was happening with her as if you had been a kid that was to stay around after the parties and help clean up. So you've got a different picture there. And I was one of the kids that often was staying around to help clean up and would sometimes have to carry her off to bed. So I really understood that that's what was going on. I was busy with my career in the medical world and working here in Louisville and living fairly close to Lou Tate and would go up there some. But as I say, for reasons I never understood, she began to shy away from me. And then finally, there was one great party that my husband had built a barbecue pit up there at her request and built it to her specifications. And there was one great, I guess it was a fall party, and Mike Kirk and Maury Weedman were in college at the time, and they came in quite late at night for the party. And it was about after everything else was put up. And so we got food out, barbecued ham and turkey, I guess it was, out and fed the kids and that had come in from college and what have you. By that time, Lou Tate had more or less gone to sleep up on the second floor of the top house where she kept a lounge that she slept on a lot. And the next morning, much to my amazement, she was quite angry with me. She called me and wanted her keys returned. She always had me keep a separate set of keys to her house to get in case there was an emergency. And she was very angry because she thought I had stolen all this ham. And there was no way that I could explain to her that I had nothing to do with this. And she didn't want me to set foot on the place then for a number of years. And this was just like losing your mother. It was just awful. I can't explain the hurt that I had. And then all of a sudden, you know, 4 or 5 years later, I get this little note in the mail that says, "Will you please come up and bring your snail's trail and cat's track coverlet and the other Palmore coverlet and your baby cradle. I need them for a show." And it was just out of the clear blue. Well, I went and I took what she requested, and it was just like that we had never stopped being together. And it was, by then, as I say, I had understood more about the disease of alcoholism. We had a lot of really hard times after that because she was getting, where her heart was not doing very well, her blood pressure was not so good, well, and she was concerned sometimes about what was happening to her as a person. And she did begin to talk to me some about that and began to talk to me some on occasion about what I knew about medical things, and alcohol was one of those medical things we had to ask questions about every now and then. She had kept on having a few classes in the evenings and odd times for students. I think the students probably absorbed more the personality and the charm of the hill than they did weaving instruction at that point in time. I had kind of gotten on her and said that all those years that I'd been hanging around up there that I knew how to do odd things, but I never knew how to warp a loom. So I finally convinced her that I had to learn to warp a loom. or I had forgotten him, because I was always supposed to get all these classes, and I ended up doing the windows or standing on my head or doing something weird instead. So her life was really changed. The research wasn't anymore. She wasn't able to do it except on a very limited basis. She got into some interesting things. Late 60s, early 70s, she started thinking about kindergartners, and she developed what she called the kindergarten loom. And I remember her pride in making that sort of a new development for a simple loom that could be reused and was within the economic range of any primary group, whether it be a kindergarten, a Sunday school class, or a little arts and crafts class, or a mother who needed something to occupy her children's time with at home, and also wanted a good use for her leftover sewing scraps. But these were some of the good times. Eventually, Lou Tate had a heart attack, quite a severe heart attack. I was at work, and the phone rings, and I'm called to the phone, and it was quite early in the morning, and they say I'm a blood banker, and the surgery at that particular hospital was going crazy, and all the morning things that happened in the hospital were in full swing, and I get this phone call, and it says, I'm sick, I think I'm having a heart attack. And there was about 2 feet of snow on the ground, and I thought, oh my goodness, how are we ever going to get you taken care of up there on that hill? So I told her, I said, well, I will. She says, help me. And she hadn't called me in months, but she was hurting. So I said, okay. And I said, you just get out of the building and get yourself, I asked her if she could walk, and she said she could. I'm wet. I hope they come home.
This is the end of side two of interview one with Ann Kuiper. Today is May 27th, 1984. My name is Tika Ward. I am interviewing Ann Kuiper. We are at 1151 Dove Road, Louisville, Kentucky. Our topic is Lou Tate and the Little Loom House. This is side one of our second tape.
Well, Lou Tate managed to get herself with a coat on and get out of the lower cabin and walk down that rough road to where her mailbox was, and she was standing there waiting for EMS, who managed to get up the hill as far as her mailbox on Kenwood Hill Drive, or Kenwood Hill Road. And they were most amazed that there was this lady having an acute heart attack standing by the road. The EMS staff was very amazed when they found the lady with a heart attack by the mailbox waiting for them. It wasn't a few minutes till she was in the hospital in intensive care. And she didn't have a doctor. Her doctor had died a number of years ago. And so when I met her in the ER, she says, well, find me a doctor. So I went and found her a doctor. And she was in intensive care for a number of days. And finally, in about a month or so, she had worked her way out of her heart attack to where she could leave the hospital. Well, this, she would talk to me about was a rebirth for her. She felt that she had missed so much, that she had become cold and cruel to many people. And she also realized that she thought she was alcoholic. It was a total change in her personality. I'm sorry to say many people had become so alienated at that time that they no longer saw it. Now, she would dip back into the old personality at times of being rather curt with people and extremely demanding, but there was a difference after that. Her brush with death was not the first one that she'd ever had. And at that time, she told me about a wonderful story. And the people that are hearing this, that will have brushed with Elizabeth Kubler Ross in her writings, will understand this story. Lou Tate said that when she was very young, maybe in her early teens, she had typhoid fever and almost died. In fact, they thought she would not live through the night. And she could remember lying in bed and being out of body and listening to her mother and the physician talk about whether or not she would live through the night. And she never had a fear of dying after that, because she felt that she had died and knew something about the other side. Well, the same thing came to her again with this heart attack experience, but it made her redirect her thoughts. About that time, for whatever reasons, I had come to realize that Lutate was going to go through some really strange times in her life. She became well acquainted with Reverend Thornwell, the chaplain there at the hospital, and who was one of my favorite people, and I think they discussed a lot of things, and she felt that she missed the boat on her relationships with people. She became ready to leave the hospital, and she couldn't go home because she couldn't climb up and down that hill. There wasn't proper bathroom facilities. It was just a disaster. Well, you can guess who was approached about, can I go to your house and stay until I get on my feet? And as it was, we had just done a little remodeling in the little house we had, and we had an extra bedrooms. We had a foster daughter there at the time, and we just remodeled and moved our bedroom upstairs, so there was a spare bedroom. So we told her to come ahead, and my husband was a little bit nonplussed at how this was going to turn out. As it was an interesting time. It was a time of a lot of communication. As she got stronger, she began to break away from somebody waiting on her and begin to reestablish her own life. During that period in time, she read the Alcoholics Anonymous book from cover to cover. And she said, I know that this was my problem. And she took a lot of the Alcoholics Anonymous program, their thoughts of surrender to a higher power, and their thoughts of the comradeship that should exist in life, to heart. I also dropped the writings of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in her lap on death and dying. In fact, I did that before she left the hospital. And I encouraged her to write her own thoughts down, because she knew she wasn't going to live too long. And if we, as people go through the Lutate archives, they're going to find envelopes, they're going to find backs of pieces of paper when she talks about the night demons that come when you're afraid to die. The night demons that come when different parts of your brain are activated because of the pain. The thoughts about the earth, the people. You'll see all kinds of comments that are sensitive and are angry as you're bargaining to try and see if you can survive on this earth a little longer. But I think that the freedom to express herself that way came from the freedom she received from reading Elizabeth Kubler-Ross books. And from being acquainted with that AA book, later on she was awakened to a whole another set of thinking when she began to read Carl Sagan and his Dragons of the Mind. And that is another story. After Lutate got back on her feet after the heart attack, well, she didn't want me around so much. And again, we'd gotten our independence, and she was doing her own thing. And she was, I believe at that time, was beginning to do tapings with a university somewhere about oral history tapings over the telephone. I don't know which one, but I believe it was one in Texas. She would never tell me who. This particular same university was courting her for the final resting place for her collections. And she became consumed with a worry as when she was gone, what was going to happen to what she tried to create. A lot of people only saw the little loom house and the cabins as weaving, and Lutate didn't see that at all. She saw it as a place where a certain type of artistic and community communion had always taken place. When she bought the place, it was rental property, but previous to that, it had kind of been a cabins that artists lived in. And previous to that, it was summer cabins for some of the elite of Louisville. She always told the story that the first Sunday schools the Presbyterian Church ever conducted in the United States were conducted right there in those cabins, and I believe the story to be true. She also told the story that the first time a happy birthday was ever sung was in those cabins, and I believe those stories to be true also. So she felt that the cabins and the charm of them in their setting created the most perfect place for people to bring the science and art and a communal type of expression together, whether it be in the form of music, and she loved to have musicians out there, an art show, or in the form of the textiles. Naturally, she wanted her textile teaching to continue, not so much for the adults, but for the children, because she thought that through the children and through them hearing how textiles had to be created to clothe us since time, early recorded time, she thought that was a way for them to learn living history. And this is the stories and the types of things she imparted to thousands of children that she invited to come out there for a school trip and never charged them a penny. You know, everything she ever made in the way of income ended up getting turned into public service for her community, which she loved. I can remember that she even tutored some students in math at one time. You know, there was just no end to what she would do for young people. And she felt every young person had the whole potential of the world before him and must have his chance. But his chance would be better developed if he understood a little bit about what had come before him. So this was where her interest in history came, and folk history, which she thought was the real history of people. So she wanted the cabins to be a place where there would be these types of things continue. She would almost have let the textile research go someplace else to be housed if she thought the cabins would continue as a place for community and for art and for people. I don't think she'd have any problem with that. At various and sundry times, she tried to corral different organizations to help her, but she would never turn loose of enough of the management for them to do any of the help that they were willing to do. So that was useless. So only after her death can some of her dreams be fulfilled, which is a very sad sort of thing, but it's not so unusual. Lutate finally got real ill, and she had to be taken back to the doctor and then to the hospital, and she was having bowel problems and couldn't eat much anymore and was losing weight, and she was in pain and agony, and it was determined that she had cancer of the bowel, and she withstood surgery. After that surgery, it was very trying times. She had to go stay in a nursing home for quite some little while. And this was the most amazing thing I have ever heard, when she would talk about the plight of the people in the nursing home around her and how they had stopped living, and how that she had ignored people like that all of her life. And so she would make little twist ties out of fabric and teach bright colored yarns and try and teach these old people how to do something colorful and fun. I can't express to you the concern that she would talk about. She says, and the empathy and the respect that she gained for hospital people, I had never thought to see that side of her. Particularly people like the nurse's aides that are the ones that are encouraging the people back to life because they're there giving the bath and giving the conversation. And she said, you know, there's so many people like this that I've ignored in my life. You know, and the conversations along that line were an education to me. I never thought thought of her as a person who ignored anybody. But yet she didn't take time to spend with people like that. She always spent with a different class, social, intellectual, what have you, class of people. So she may have been reading herself right. It's just that I would not have thought about it that way, and it was amazing to me. I mentioned Carl Sagan. It was during that time that someone introduced her to Carl Sagan and the Dragons of the Mind, and she couldn't wait for me to read this book after she read it, and the conversations we had about left side and right side of brain were just amazing. And she says, now I understand where the similarity in so many of the patterns that we have woven and used in textiles come from. Because all people in certain types of their brains, Carl Sagan thought the same thoughts were common to humanity. And she says, this is where the winged dragons and serpents and what have you come from. And this was just like magic to her. And she wanted to get a hold of more of this type of thinking and see where it would lead her. She eventually was able to come back to the cabins, and there were rough times. So again, she pushed me out of her life. And this was very hard because I did not want to be pushed out. But she did. Then, at that point in time, when we did get together, she wanted to talk about these affairs of philosophy. And I wondered if she could only talk about that so often, and with just certain people. I know some other people she talked about these sorts of things with. She was very supportive to me when we did get together on things I was interested in doing, and gave me insight into things I wanted to do. She was very supportive of me getting into foster care with teenage girls. And I almost felt that if she had been given that opportunity years before, she would have done the same thing. When we decided to adopt special needs children, she was the one that said, that's okay. And gave us the sort of blessing that I needed, because I had people in my family that said this was not the thing to do. But she never faltered. She said, that's great, that's okay. That's being what you want to be and doing what you want to do with whom you want to do it, and not ignoring anybody in life. And she would sit there and tell me that. But then she'd say, I love you. And I love the children for it. So she accepted these sorts of things from me in the last that no one else did. And it was a little bit like getting her back as mother, because I had really always used her as one. Her last hospital admission, a good friend of mine called me and said, we'll take her to the hospital. She's very sick. She wants to see you. And I went immediately. And we talked. And she told me that she was working on her will. And she would tell me that she wanted me to make sure that certain pieces of property went to certain people. She had a book where she was working on it. It was all laid out. Most of those things were accomplished. A lot of people came to see her those last few weeks. There was funny times and there was sad times. She had one great Christmas and one great Christmas party before she died. And I think you'd find people that have pictures of her. She was wearing a jacket at the Christmas party. It was an Indian jacket from one of the Indian groups in Florida. It's colorful and bright. She brought me an apron from there when she came back. That was her last big trip. And she saw things there that she talked about there a lot of the last few weeks of her life. She saw some place there that they had a living museum, or what she called a living museum, where instead of seeing the coverlet on the wall, the child could come feel and weave and do. And she says, museums are no good unless you can touch. You know, and whatever you do, don't let my stuff be dead. Let people handle and feel. She talked about the friends that she made during that time. She'd had two great last trips. After her heart attack, she'd gone up to Canada and spent some time teaching of the, I may have the wrong term, I want to say campfire girls, which would be our equivalent of the Girl Scouts. And she went up to Cape Breton. The trip to Cape Breton in Canada was after Lou Tate's heart attack, and she summoned up her courage for this kind of a trip and her health condition, and off she went. And I believe the lady's name that she visited was Florence Mackey. And she came back, as usual, with baskets and trinkets from the Indians and fun and lore. She brought me a cookbook. She brought me a butterfly embedded in some glass. It's just beautiful. And she brought me stories of a little lady living up on an island and
walking with a walking stick like she did, and they were two kindred spirits, really women who did their own thing. And she talked about that trip a lot in the last few weeks of her life, and as I say, she talked about a trip to Florida that she had made. I'd taken her to the bus when she went to Florida, and it was an unusual traveling situation. She had borrowed a traveling bag from me, I believe, and one I had purchased at a convention, and she didn't have anything to put her stuff in. It suited her, but this worked out fine. And we'd gotten her a new raincoat because she just really didn't think that she could travel with her old raincoat, and off she went. Now, stuffed in those bags, she had family pieces of heirloom silver and things like this that she stopped off, I believe in Georgia, to leave off to her niece, Barbara, the things she wanted her to have and to have one last visit with her. Then she went on to Florida and had that great time. She'd come back and, you know, had some more time in her life, and her last Christmas party she truly enjoyed. But the spring came, and that was as far as she could go in this life. I remember going to see her in the hospital and taking a little blonde-headed boy with me that we were in the process of adopting. And her saying, "I'm so glad you're paying attention to the little ones." I remember going to see her the night she died, and she was in such pain. And I stayed for hours with her that night, and one of my friends was a nurse that was on duty. We talked, and I stayed a long time, and finally I realized she would not live through the night, and she did. She woke up from her pain, and she said, "I've always loved you. I want you to know that. Now you must come home. I have to do this by myself." And she did. Early that morning, I got the call that she was dead. I wasn't surprised that she had to do it by herself, that she'd done all the rest of her life. And I recognized that in her. I don't know of anyone that has influenced what I do or don't do more than Ruth Tate. I purposely don't do some of the things that she did that hurt people. I try and catch myself in time. Because I saw it, I felt the hurt. I purposely do some of the things that people might see as a little bit eccentric or odd, because I know that isn't going to hurt you that much. I have worked hard with the foundation. I'm so glad we have it. The last year or so, I have had a lot of problems that are within my personal life and haven't been able to devote as much time to the foundation as I would have liked. But that's okay too. Now there are other people interested that have a fresh perspective and can take Lou Tate's ideas and the place that she had and develop it for new ways. And she would like that. That's important. The living history that we're participating in today is part of that. She never wanted to be sanctified, as she would have called it, or made into some sort of a an honored person that was put up on a shelf and too much idolized. She knew she wasn't that. She had a fear that that might happen to her. That's one reason I've told you some of the things about her that she wouldn't want you to know. Where she did great and where she didn't do so great. But both reasons are because she was a human being and she lived it to the fullest. If you listen to the tapes, you'll find that people have been strongly influenced by the tape. more than anything else, they're influenced to live their lives as fully as possible and to be creatures of their own mind, have the courage of their convictions, no matter what it is, whether it's in their personal life, with their family, whether it's in their business life, whatever it is. She made you understand that more than any other person I ever came in contact with. I have to tell you that she was my mother in many ways, but I also have to tell you that since my mother died, my biological mother died, and my grandmother raised me, I only heard the sanctified side of my mother from my grandmother. But from Lou Tate, who was my mother's friend as another woman, I learned about her as a complete woman and as a person. So I had to always realize that she didn't sanctify anybody any more than she would want to be sanctified. There's a lot of other little stories I could tell you, but these are the important ones. As we go along with these tapes, the little insights and funny things will come to everybody. We'll either jot them down or run another tape here, there, and yonder. But I really want you to know a little about her as I knew her. And I knew her as a second mom, which no one else did. I was able to do one or two final things for Lou Tate, whom I knew as a mother. She wanted to be cremated. And that was all right by me. But as it all turned out, we ended up having an overnight in a funeral home with everybody to come and view. So I thought, well, she would just absolutely be crushed at this idea of getting decked out in something that a funeral home would have. So we took the bright red Seminole blouse to the funeral home and we asked him to dress her in that. And they did. And then we took a coverlet and we draped the casket with a coverlet. And we found some flowers growing in the yard. And we made even that as much Lou Tate as I was physically and mentally able to do with the help of her friends. And then she was cremated. And her ashes did come back to the cabins that she loved. She had asked that her ashes be scattered here on the hill. We had a memorial service for her when her brother from up in New York and a nephew that she had raised came to visit. And after it was all over and everybody was gone but the brother, and incidentally he stayed at my house too, the brother was there. I told him what she wanted and he said, I know, she told me that too. And here is this gentleman way up in years. We took the ashes, and we walked, and we scattered them. So we returned her spirit and her bones to where she wanted to be, as she asked. And I was so glad that at last one of her family, her blood family, was able to do something for her, because it really meant a lot to the brother, that it meant a lot.
This is the end of side one, the second take.